That sound you're hearing is water rushing over a 1920s concrete dam in Tomahawk Creek, leading to the mill race of the old Anderson Mill in Chatham, Virginia. There are the frogs and the crickets from the mill pond, a bullfrog, if you listen closely, and once in a while, a barn owl that lives in the tree behind the mill screeches. This is Tour Guide Tell All, and I'm Candon, taking our weekly Monday mini episode in a different direction. Focus on an off-the-beaten-path memorial or museum in Washington, D.C., but I am not in D.C. right now. Tours are back up on a private basis, but they are pretty few and far between. There is not enough work for the whole D.C. by foot team, but my husband and I are involved in a project to restore the mill, and figured without much else going on, and a lot more room for our two toddlers to run around, we should put in some manual labor this summer. It has been a fascinating project and a challenge to do historical research during a pandemic. So on this episode of Tour Guide Tell All, we head south of D.C. on Route 29 through Charlottesville and Lynchburg, past the county seat of Pittsylvania County, the town of Chatham. You turn left at Fay's Mini Mart in Climax and head about 3 miles down Route 649. In the early 1800s, this was the Anderson family farmland. Today, Watt Odie Anderson and his wife Nancy are buried in overgrown plots just off the road on the left next to some sheds. Watt and Nancy had many children. One of the youngest, a son named Edward, became a brigadier general during World War I, and he is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Now, Arlington has been closed to the public since March, but as soon as it reopens, I hope to go find his grave. Maybe add his story to my tour. The Andersons were farmers, and like many farming families in Southern Virginia, they enslaved black men to help. In my research, I haven't been able to find out much about any of the enslaved persons forced to work on the Andersons' land. There was one man named William Anderson. There's this photograph from the 1890s that shows the grown children of Watt Odie Anderson, and sitting on the bottom row, it also lists, quote, former slave William Anderson. And I know that Nancy's family was well off, and she likely brought enslaved persons into the marriage and family life. Watt and Nancy's son, James Anderson, is the family line that we want to focus on. James and his younger brother, George, would both join the Confederate Army during the Civil War. A lot of my research at the beginning of the pandemic was about James' time during the war. James is not actually the person we want to focus on. Really, it's his son, Odie Watt Anderson. But historic research from quarantine is limited to what you can find online. Civil War history is a popular topic, and a lot of it has been digitized. James joined the 57th Virginia Regiment of the Confederate Army in 1861. So I began my research with his company, the Pig River Grays. The 57th fought at most of the big battles you probably heard of. They were at, and by extension, I assume James was at, Manassas, Antietam, the battles of the Overland Campaign around Richmond. Now, at the beginning of this, I was just going to go with that. Assumptions that if the Pig River Grays were there, then so is he. Now, I did have records of his being wounded at Drury's Bluff and sent home for a few weeks before returning to the 57th. But, as luck would have it, the owner of the mill from the 1970s to the 1990s was a cousin of the Andersons, and he's not only alive and happy to talk, he happens to live down the street from my parents in Durham, North Carolina. And he has a copy of James Anderson's Civil War diary, as well as some of the family lore about his wartime experience. The two big stories. Anderson was at Pickett's Charge in Gettysburg, and was one of the few Confederate soldiers who made it over the wall at the angle before Armistead was shot and they all retreated. Now I want to pause here and say that if you hear a hint of excitement, I must admit it, but please don't mistake it for reverence. As a historian, finding firsthand sources that you didn't even know existed is exciting. I find James' wartime stories fascinating. The major battles he saw, the things he did, but I do not find them worthy of praise because of the reason he was fighting, the continuation of slavery. But a person's life story isn't all right or all wrong, and I do think his story is worth sharing, if only for the sheer cinematic drama of his wartime experiences as a backdrop to his time after the war. The other big story about his war experience is the end of it. Family legend says he walked home from Appomattox. Now, there's no way to prove this, but there's also no reason not to believe it. The 57th was there. He wasn't a high-ranking official. At this time, he was a sergeant. So it's not surprising that he's not on the parole list. It would have taken longer for him to wait for parole than it would have just to walk home to Chatham. In 1888, after the death of his father and being entrusted with the family land and care of his sister's share of the estates, James built a wooden dam on Tomahawk Creek and a sawmill, which he used to fell trees on the property and build a 3-story grist mill. And that is my mill. Like middle-aged men who get sport cars or boats and give them a female pronoun. Oh my God, is 36 middle-aged? Is this my midlife crisis? Well, regardless, she's a beauty. She's a little rough around the edges, and you know, rough around the middle too. The first time I visited the property was early January 2020. It was a bit more fallen down than I expected, but I had hope. It was filled to the rafters. There were 19 different size coolers, a set of skis, mechanical engineering equipment from a previous owner, a palace organ that doesn't work, a framed beaver skin hanging on the wall, and a whole lot of junk. As we've been sifting and sorting, we have found a lot of the original mill equipment, little pieces that are usually easily lost after decades of being shut down. We found it all, not always in the right place and sometimes in pieces, but it's there nonetheless. The mill operated from 1888 till 1988. A century of grinding flour that you can still see on the walls today. In the 1980s, a small-scale artisanal flour and corn mill, it was just no longer in vogue, unlike today. And the property was turned into a vineyard, and the main floor of the mill became the tasting room. The mill equipment sat there, part of the tour of the winery, but no longer working. I don't know much about mill machinery or how it works, and since we're still in the cleanup phase of renovations, I still haven't learned yet. That will be a future episode, but a few things about the mill. There is a water wheel, but it's unique. The water wheel is underneath the mill, rather than on the side like you normally see. It looks as if the mill was built around it, which is unfortunate. Since the water wheel stopped turning almost 40 years ago, it's been sitting in water. The bottom half has rusted away. And if it was even possible to get a new wheel, and I mean, I guess suppose it is possible, but it's not in our budget, the wheel would have to be built in place under the mill. It was originally built as a grist mill. We have the original French burr stones that were used to grind the flour. In the 19-teens and 20s, a roller mill was installed. Imagine very large rolling pins. It's called a midget marvel, which is just, it's a great name. And while they were very popular in the time, there don't seem to be that many anymore. The mill enthusiasts who have been helping me with the technical aspects of restoring a mill were all very excited about this find. I like to think of myself as pretty handy, but carpentry and mechanical engineering are not in my wheelhouse. Most of the actual manual labor of restoring the mill has fallen to the capable hands of my dad, who I am positive is not listening. So, hey mom, tell dad that I gave him a shout out in the podcast. My role in this has been getting the property listed on the National Registry of Historic Places, a feat I am proud to say has already crossed the first hurdle, as the Virginia Department of Historical Resources has already approved the first step of the application unanimously. In addition to the mill, there's an old house on the property. It's where we're living for the summer. The common belief was that the house was originally built as a general store and post office, run by James Anderson's brother Charles and his wife Nanny. Now, I don't want to be the outsider who comes in and tells all the locals that they're wrong, but that's wrong. As soon as I walked into the house, it doesn't feel like a general store or post office. So that was my first task. Let's figure out this house. In the interest of time and not boring you with my historical research process, for example, the other night I stayed up till 2 a.m. reading every postal application from Virginia from the 1890s. And I was trying to find the one for the Tomahawk Post Office that was submitted by Nanny Anderson. Being a historian is tedious, but I did find it. So here's the story of the house. Charles and Nanny did have a general store and a post office here, and it was probably on the same side as the house. When James Anderson built the mill, he was still living in the family home down the street. There was a small miller's cabin on the property, and it was really only dismantled about 3 years ago, where the miller lived. I don't know much about the original millers from James' time. I did find, written on the loading dock door in the mill in pencil, a note, W.A. Mitchell, Miller, left this mill on, illegible, the 20th, 1897. But anyway, James didn't live right next to the mill. The Anderson family home burnt down around 1901. I read that in a few sources, and the house on that parcel of land now was built in 1910, so it does fit. James traded Charles the old family farmland for the store of the post office, which never made any money, and he likely tore it down. He moved into the miller's cabin and started building this house. Mike, an architectural historian who works for the Virginia DHR, helped me confirm a few details about the house that date it to between 1900 and 1910. It's a three-story house, but only the first floor and half of the second floor are finished. And that was always a weird thing to me. But if James started building the house in the first years of the 20th century, he died in 1908, so perhaps he left the house only half completed. And that is where Odie Watt Anderson arrives. Odie was a lifelong bachelor who wouldn't need a three-story house, so why finish it? There is a door between the finished and the unfinished parts of the house, so no need to add bedrooms that wouldn't be slept in. When Odie was born, the family were still farmers, and the mill wasn't built yet. He was a young boy when James built the mill, and Odie remembers throwing his shovel in joy. He hated farming. When we started this project, I knew that Odie was a graduate of the Virginia Polytech Institute, what we call Virginia Tech. But not much else beyond that. Here's where historian focus comes in. I read every page of the digitized yearbooks for the 1901 to 1906 classes to find out what I could about him. Odie was older than his classmates because he spent some time working to save up tuition. He joined as a special student, which was usually a two-year agricultural certificate program. But something changed his mind, and in 1902, he joined the mechanical engineering department, and he joined the Corps of Cadets. With the Corps, he went to the St. Louis World Fair, but he didn't join any clubs or any sports. He graduated in 1905, and he was working as a mechanical engineer when his father died. At that point, he had half-siblings who were still young children, and they had now lost both their mom and dad, and he had a mill. So Odie came back to Chatham, and with his sister Kate, helped raise the kids and run the mill. Neither Odie nor Kate ever married, and they lived their whole lives in this house. Odie was the miller here from 1908 until his death in 1974. Odie replaced the wooden dam with a concrete dam in the 1920s. We found an old belt-driven concrete mixer from the 1920s in the back room of the mill, and we have decided that that was the one they used to build the dam. He also dismantled the sawmill, reinforced the foundation, replaced the grist mill with the midget marble roller mill, and he built a hand-dug well that we still use today. In the concrete all around the mill today, you can see his initials overlapped, O-W-A, carved in. Odie was the one who secured the contract with the Lane Furniture Company. The mill provided flour to make the glue. He kept the mill running, the community fed and employed, during two world wars and the Great Depression. Since he only died in the 1970s, I hope to one day learn more about him as an individual, not just his work on the mill. But the pandemic threw a wrench in my historical research plans. The county courthouse, which has the deeds and the wills and the building permits, they're open, but I'm not sure I feel comfortable going in just yet. The local Baptist church that the Anderson family helped build, they probably have some records or stories, but services are virtual. and the County Volunteer Fire Department's fish fry this year was a drive-through. Odie's birthday is August 6th. I had hoped to throw a party to introduce us to the community as the new stewards of the mill, hoping to gather stories, like the one I got from a Facebook message where a local man said his dad used to work here when it was a mill, and he remembered when Odie fell into the mill race and broke his leg. I have a list of documents that I know exist. Old rural postal routes that might confirm that the post office was on the same side as the house. But until the archives open, I can't actually see the documents to find out. I was able to answer one question that kept popping up, though. Today, there are two driveways connected in a long loop. One in front of the house and one in front of the mill. The house has a small set of steps, more of a stoop than a perch. There's no porch light. There's no garden out front. There's really nothing more than a gravel parking spot and an unmowed wooded patch of land between the house and the road. The other side of the house has this grand covered porch, lovely concrete steps leading to a sidewalk from the gravel driveway. It seems odd for the back of a house, right? And yet, in talking with a few older locals, they always referred to this side of the house as the front or out front. Thanks to aerial photographs taken each decade since the 1950s, I found out that the road in front of the house is new. The gravel driveway leading to the house is also new. So the original driveway was the one that led to the mill, where the road met the driveway and then curved away in the opposite direction of the house. The driveway from the mill followed along the mill race, came up the hill, and ended at the porch of the house, making that the front of the house. I have a lot more questions about the house and the mill that I need to answer before I can submit the final step in getting the property listed on the registry. And we have a lot of work to do on the restoration of the mill before it's open to visitors. I hope one day I can come back to the podcast with an update and an address to say, hey, come check it out. The water wheel doesn't spin, but the gears do, and we got the Midget Marvel running. We probably won't grind flour, but we can show you how they did it. And when you walk in, you'll see a photo of James Anderson, his son Odie, and hopefully I'll be there to give you a tour of the place. And I'll know a lot more about how mills work by then. If you want to know more about the journey, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Watts Mill VA. That's WATTSMILLVA. We renamed it Watts Mill after Odie Watt Anderson. Or you can find us at wattsmill.com. Tour Guide Tell All will be back on Thursday with another episode. You can help support Becca, Rebecca, Dan, and me, Candon, by subscribing to the podcast or by becoming a monthly patron for early access and special episodes at patreon.com/tourguidetellall. Not up for recurring support? We have a Venmo account. You can donate to tourguide-tellall. Email us at tourguidetellall@gmail.com. with any questions or comments or just to say hello. I leave you with Odie's senior year quote from the 1905 VPI yearbook. It seems especially fitting for a year of pandemic and economic uncertainty, or it could be taken literally as I had to move to Virginia for the summer to do this project. I have learned, in whatsoever state I am in, herewith to be content. Ooh, ooh, ooh.